Two masters of the mystery genre talk about writing crime fiction.
The nice thing about the murder and crime genre is that it allows you to do as much or as little as you want to do. For example, you can take a crime and have the book be all about the solution to the crime, the investigation, and the ultimate arrest of the guilty party. And that can be the only thing that's going on in the book. Or you can have that skeleton, that framework of the investigation, and you can hang upon that skeleton as much as you want. You can do a more thorough exploration of character. You can really address the setting. You can use the setting as a character. You can more deeply explore themes. You can more deeply explore individual characters. So it's a large amount of stuff you can do in a crime novel. And so it can be as simple as you want or as complicated as you want.
That's Elizabeth George. We talk with her about the latest in her Inspector Linley series, The Punishment She Deserves. Then, Anthony Horowitz of Foyle's War, House of Silk, the Alex Rider Mysteries, and many more, share some secrets, both personal and professional.
I think from the very day I began writing, I was trying to escape, in a way, from myself and from my experiences. That's why I was so keen on adventure stories. I love plot, I love story, I love action, and I love mystery and magic and surprises. I try not to be a particularly introspective writer. I'm much more interested in giving readers a fun ride. But that ride for me is a ride away from where I was. And the question I sometimes ask myself and have been asked is, would I exchange success as a writer in my adulthood for a happy childhood and less sort of unpleasantness at this school? And to that question, I don't really know the answer. I'm just aware that those very formative years from 8 to about 18 turned me into the writer that I am, and I knew I would be this writer when I was 10 years old.
Horowitz tells us about his new book, The Word is Murder. It's a meta-mystery romp that invites the reader in behind the scenes of writing mystery fiction. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Like the great writer P.D. James, Elizabeth George's murder mysteries explore in depth the psychological motivations of her characters. She's best known for her Inspector Linley series, now counting 20, including the one we talk about today, The Punishment She Deserves. The first 11 books in the series have been adapted for BBC TV as the Inspector Linley mysteries. In The Punishment She Deserves, the working-class sergeant Barbara Havers teams up again with aristocratic Inspector Thomas Linley to solve the murder of a local deacon in the historic town of Ludlow, England. As usual, the pair have to fight the headwinds of testy superiors who seem more concerned about insubordination than about solving the murder. And almost anyone could be the killer. The setting is a character, too. Small-town England in the grip of austerity, where there aren't enough policemen anymore to keep the town safe. The lies we tell ourselves to avoid confronting our pain is a major theme of the novel, and the consequences lead the characters to the punishment they deserve. Once again, in The Punishment She Deserves, Elizabeth George has succeeded in creating a masterful work of suspense. Elizabeth George, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, this was just a terrific novel, The Punishment She Deserves. It's your 20th Inspector Linley novel, the first in 3 years. They started out with A Great Deliverance, published in 1988, and first briefly describe the two main characters first, and then I'll ask you about Isabel Ardrey, Inspector Linley and Barbara Havers, his partner.
Sure. When I first created this series, I thought one of the fun things for me as a writer would be to write about someone who had a lifestyle utterly unlike mine, and someone who wasn't burdened by a low police salary and having to live in a some grungy place with a neon light going on and off outside his bedroom window. And so I decided to create this character, Thomas Lindley, who was going to be titled and who was going to have a family pile out in Cornwall and who would live at a nice place in London and essentially be someone who got into police work largely because of a social conscience and a social conscience that leads him to feel pretty guilty about the fact that he was born into this very lucky situation where he has no physical kinds of wants, material wants. And so in contrast with him, Detective Sergeant Barbara Havers is a working class girl who is fairly well educated. She certainly and is certainly no dummy, but she comes from a circumstance entirely different from his. And when they are first assigned to work together in A Great Deliverance, Barbara Havers is absolutely appalled by this idea because she can't stand this guy. She thinks that he's a toff. She thinks that he has slept his way around New Scotland Yard. She thinks that he is insufferable, and here she is having to go up to Yorkshire and work with him. And of course, you can't really sustain that kind of a relationship of opposites if they are always at each other's throats, because then you'd book after book you'd have this exact same thing going on. And so part of what I was doing is to set the framework for what was going to become a relationship in which these two individuals from entirely different backgrounds come to really love and respect each other, not as physical lovers, but certainly as emotional lovers that are of constant support to each other. So that's what I was looking at in the beginning, and that was where I was heading.
Yeah, it's just a great companionship there. And then there's Isabel Ardery, who also plays a role in several of the books and many of the books. Tell us about her.
Well, Isabel Ardery came into the series a number of books ago, in a book called Playing for the Ashes. And at that time, the book takes place mostly largely out in Kent. Isabel Ardery is, in that book, the fire investigator, arson investigator. And she doesn't play a huge role in that book, but when Malcolm Weberly retires after A Traitor to Memory, I realized that this would be a really good opportunity to bring Isabel back as the superior officer to Thomas Lindley and to Barbara Havers. So she joined the cast again in a book called I can't even think of the title of the book. I've written so many. This Body of Death. She comes back and is heading that investigation. And so Isabel is a troubled character, and we sort of get hints of her trouble early on in the book, in This Body of Death. But then, as it turns out, she is far more troubled than she first appears in that novel. And this book is the book that examines her personal story with far greater intimacy than it has been examined before.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating story. Now, they're called the Inspector Lindley novels, but the real main character in many ways is Barbara Havers. Why didn't you call them the Barbara Havers mysteries?
Well, I think that Barbara Havers is, she's such an appealing character, and she's so beloved by the readers, mostly because of how bad she can be when it comes to obeying orders, and she has a really strong attitude, very very amusing character. But I never intended her to be really the central character in the books. I really I have a large cast of characters, and so what happens is that characters step forward in individual books sort of to have their story featured. Her story's been featured a lot. And I think that she's somebody that people can relate to because she has so many personal you know, personal issues, personal struggles that are unlike the other people's struggles in the books. You know, she certainly has this enormous chip on her shoulder. She's come out of the working class and is, you know, rubbing elbows with this this guy who's from the, you know, the upper classes. And all of that brings out in her this really kind of amusing attitude that she shows to the readers. But central, I think, to the story is her relationship with Lindley and how that relationship grows and changes and develops. And I think that that's what I'm taking a look at, more than just as Barbara Habers, looking at Barbara Habers as an individual on her own.
And before we get a little bit to the plot of this latest, The Punishment She Deserves, she and Isabel are the ones who start out. Lindley doesn't come in until fair amount of ways into the book. And Elizabeth Ardery and her superior, I suppose, the assistant commissioner, Sir David Hillier, have so much animus against Barbara Habers. Why is that?
Because she has caused them so much trouble. Barbara's initial sin has had many sins over the series, but her big sin in recent books was the fact that she used a connection with a tabloid and a connection with a tabloid reporter to embarrass Scotland Yard and embarrass them enough that they would take up a case. And the fact that this is easily traceable to Barbara Habers is the first nail in her coffin. And then on top of that, when they don't send her over to Italy, which is where this case has occurred, to British nationals, when they don't send her over there to deal with it, she just goes on her own and doesn't even let them know she's going to do it. So she just disappears. And obviously could have been fired for doing that, but because of Lindley's intercession, instead what they do is they have her sign paperwork that will, when filed, send her to Berwick-upon-Tweed up in the north of England. So that's the way they're trying to control her. She just has this streak in her that urges her to go off on her own and follow a wild hare on occasion.
So now let's talk a little bit about this book. Tell us about the setting. It's a small medieval town of Ludlow. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Ludlow has connections with British history, very strong connections, in that it was used by the various branches of the Plantagenet family as they came into power and went out of power, specifically during the Wars of the Roses and before and then again after. So it has a real historical significance, and especially to me because I'm really into that particular period of time with the battling Plantagenets and the Wars of the Roses. The thing about Ludlow that I found so interesting was the fact that in addition to having this castle, which is dominates above the city on a hillside, they also have 500 listed buildings, some of which are medieval buildings. In England, if a building is listed, it means that, first of all, you can't ever tear it down, and secondly, that you can make only particular changes to the building, certainly nothing on the exterior of it. So it's very, very atmospheric, with narrow streets and twisting byways. And it has two rivers that actually form a natural moat around the old part of the city and around the castle as well. So it's the kind of place that I really love to prowl around, because it has so many interesting nooks and crannies that suggest story to me.
Hmm. I share your love of the Wars of the Roses. I think Richard III was one of my favorite Shakespeare plays.
Oh, yeah.
When I was a kid. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Elizabeth George about her newest Inspector Lindley novel, The Punishment She Deserves. So now Ian Druitt, he is a respected deacon of the Church of England, and he is found dead after having been arrested on suspicion of pedophilia. talk a little bit about the crime. Obviously, you're not going to give important things away, but set us up.
Yeah. So Ian Druitt has been a deacon in the Church of England in Ludlow at St. Lawrence Church for a good number of years. And he's been very good at his job. He's also been an inveterate volunteer because he sees that as part of how he can serve the church and serve the community. He's accused of pedophilia anonymously, and because of the concerns that have arisen over the years in England regarding pedophilia and Anglican priests, just like United States, regarding pedophilia and Catholic priests, he is brought in for questioning. But what happens is that there have been enormous cutbacks in police personnel in the area that this occurs. Particularly, they have eliminated so many police officers that now in this enormous area, which comprises three different counties in England, there are only 1,800 officers left that are on the beat. And because of this, a number of police stations have actually been closed down to the public, although the police still use them themselves to go in and use the computers, etc. So the Police Community Support Officer, PCSO, is the person who is charged with arresting Ian Druitt and taking him to the police station in town, the closed police station, to wait for the arrival of a patrol officer that is going to take him up back to Shrewsbury, which is where they have an actual official police station open. And that sort of sets the scene for what happens, because while he's there in police custody in this abandoned police station, he hangs himself.
Or so we think.
Yeah.
Now, the title, The Punishment She Deserves, you know, I thought it could be about Havers because obviously she's under scrutiny. But I also wondered if it was actually about Isabel Ardrey, because there is much in this book about how people torment themselves, you know, the kind of the stupid self-destructive things that people do. And I wonder if you could talk about kind of that theme. It's not just Isabel Ardrey, but also a number of the characters where they just seem to be motivated by these lies they tell themselves that end up just destroying them.
Yes. And that's exactly right. The theme of the book is expressed at the beginning of part two, where there is a quotation from Raymond Teller of Penn and Teller. I heard him interviewed on NPR, and he said something that really struck me when they were asking him about what the audience sees and what the audience believes when an illusionist is working. And he said, nothing fools you better than the lie you tell yourself. When I heard that, I thought, that's it. That's what this book is really about, is the lies that people tell themselves, and ultimately how these lies lead to various ways in which, yes, in which they are punished. And so the punishment she deserves can refer to Isabel Ardrey. It can also refer to the Deputy Chief Constable, Clover Freeman, who is assigned to that area. It can refer to the character of Missa. It can refer to the character of Ding. I mean, when you think about it, it really has broad application to virtually all the characters in the story.
And another theme, you mentioned some of the characters' names. Another theme is the relationships between parents and children. And, of course, some of these lies are really operational when it comes to how parents are trying to keep their children safe, but, in fact, everything they do drives them away from safety.
Yes, exactly. And I think a lot of parents do that. They're very, very well-intentioned. And in this book, you know, it's a case where the parents feel that they know best about what their children should and shouldn't do, and the decisions their children should and shouldn't make. And you're right. What happens as a result of that is they do enormous damage to the relationship they have with their children instead of sustaining a relationship with them.
And another sub-theme is addiction, whether that be Isabel Ardrey's alcohol addiction, the drug addiction of another character, and even possibly sex addiction. So is that part of this theme of lies or some other aspect?
No, that's part of what's going on in the book is people sort of the dawning awareness of how addiction has taken over their lives. So that's a strong part of it, absolutely.
Hmm. So now I just wanted to ask you, this has been also, your books have been made into a BBC TV series. I just want to ask you about what one can gain in print in a genre of this kind, in the particular kind of psychological mystery that you write versus, you know, a TV treatment.
Well, I think that in a television show, frequently when a book is adapted, they sort of pick and choose. And in the case of my novels, the decision that the BBC made was to reduce the books on film, just to the crime and the investigation. Mm-hmm. And what that ended up doing is providing the viewer with less of an experience than the reader had when reading the book. When you're doing a book, you can, you know, delve pretty deeply into somebody's psychopathology in ways that with words, you know, and you can go into their thoughts and their speculations, their reflections, their tortured psyches. In a film, all this has to be expressed right there on the screen with the behavior, with the actions and the reactions and the physical expressions of that the actor is using during individual scenes. So it's a lot different experience. I think that the reading experience is much broader, much more fulfilling, offering much more of an experience of being inside of a character's head and experiencing what a character is experiencing than a film can do.
Yeah, and it almost seems to me, and of course, correct me if I'm wrong, that's your real driving interest in your books, is what's going on inside your characters' heads. But it seems that the murder mystery genre is particularly suited to that.
I think that's true. The nice thing about the murder and crime genre is that it allows you to do as much or as little as you want to do. For example, you can take a crime and have the book be all about the solution to the crime, the investigation, and the ultimate arrest of the guilty party. And that can be the only thing that's going on in the book. Or you can have that skeleton, that framework of the investigation, and you can hang upon that skeleton as much as you want. You can do a more thorough exploration of character. You can really address the setting. You can use the setting as a character. You can more deeply explore themes. You can more deeply explore individual characters. So it's a large amount of stuff you can do in a crime novel. And so it can be as simple as you want or as complicated as you want.
And we are so glad that you've set your mind to doing these amazing books. I can't wait to go back and actually start reading the first one and then go forward. I want to thank you so much, Elizabeth George, for talking with us about this latest one, The Punishment She Deserves, and coming back to Writer's Voice.
Thanks very much for having me.
Elizabeth George is the author of numerous novels of crime fiction, including the Inspector Linley series. Next up, we talk with another master of the murder mystery, novelist, screenwriter, and playwright Anthony Horowitz. He's the creator of Foyle's War, Moriarty, House of Silk, and so much more. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Anthony Horowitz is the best-selling author of Magpie Murders, House of Silk, and Moriarty, as well as the TV crime dramas Foyle's War and Midsummer Murders. Now he's brilliantly reinvented the classic crime novel by writing a fictional version of himself as a Watson to a modern-day Holmes. In his latest book, The Word is Murder, out June 5th from HarperCollins, Horowitz has created a meta-mystery that's hugely fun to read. Meta, because it's a vehicle for the author to invite us behind the scenes of what it takes to write a mystery novel. When Diana Cooper enters a funeral parlor one morning to plan her own funeral, she doesn't know that 6 hours later she'll be dead, strangled with a curtain cord in her own home. Former police detective Daniel Hawthorne is brought in to solve the case. He'd left Scotland Yard under a cloud, but he's still the go-to man for the cops when the case is too tough for them to crack. But Hawthorne wants someone to write his story, to restore his reputation. The two develop a kind of friendship despite the strains of their tussles over how the book will be written. That's all part of the fun in reading the book. Meanwhile, the plot wends its intricate way to a surprising resolution. We spoke with Anthony Horowitz last year about Magpie Murders, which also featured a mystery writer. This time, in The Word is Murder, Anthony Horowitz steps forward from behind the curtain to create a masterful mystery that showcases his talent at its best. Well, Anthony Horowitz, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
This book, The Word is Murder, I've just told you this just as we were going to start the interview. I love your books, but this one is my favorite.
Well, that's very kind of you. I'm so happy to hear it since it's the most recent. That's great. And also because I'm halfway through the sequel at the moment, so that's encouraging too.
You have a sequel planned for
this? Another Word for Murder is on the computer screen in front of me at this very moment.
Oh, I can't wait. One of the reasons that I loved this book so much, I suppose because I have a show talking to writers not only about their books, but also about writing. This is a book in which you figure, you, Anthony Horowitz, figure very prominently. And
yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
So, in fact, you're a major character in the book. Why did you decide to make yourself a character?
Okay, well, the reason I was jumping in there, Francesca, was that I don't want your listeners to think that this is sort of some kind of ego trip and the book is about me. I am the narrator of the book. I'm not the hero of it, and I don't spend any time in the book, talking about my life, my success, or whatever you might think. I am really the Dr. Watson figure in this book, and the detective, a man called Daniel Hawthorne, is the true hero. But the reason I put myself into the book is really, you've already touched on it. I wanted to write about writing. That's where I started, because I've been writing for, oh goodness, professionally for more than 30 years, and I wanted to sort of write in the style of Stephen King, wrote a wonderful book called On Writing, and William Goldman, Adventures in the Screen Trade, where I actually looked at sort of the whole nature of whodunits and murder mysteries and why we enjoy them and how they're written and what it's like to be a writer. But the trouble was that when I tried to write just an ordinary book like that, it became quite boring. It became a little bit self-referential. So I then had the idea that if I put myself into a whodunit, I could have, on the one hand, the fun of a murder mystery with all the clues, the twists, the turns, the suspects, and the red herrings, and all that. But on the other hand, I could quietly look at the very nature of a whodunit. So that's why I did it.
And we should mention for our listeners, there's a little bit of interference on the line, although we can hear you quite clearly, probably because there's a big storm happening.
You have rung me, and this, it seems somehow quite appropriate. Here we are talking murder. You rung me in the middle of a huge storm in London. The lightning is really impressive. I'm sitting in my office at the moment, and I can see St. Paul's Cathedral and the Old Bailey and the Shard in front of me. And there's white mist everywhere and incredible fork lightning slicing through the sky, and your listeners may occasionally pick up the sound of rumbling thunder too. And I think it has played a little havoc with our call, although so far so good.
Oh yeah, and in fact I think that is what I heard, was thunder in the background.
That's right. It's very spooky and atmospheric.
So now back to the word is murder. I mean, even the title, in a way, is a play on this theme of writing about mystery writing.
That's right. It's words and it's murder. You know, the setup of the book is that Hawthorne, who is a disgraced Scotland Yard detective who has been fired from his job and is now working as a private consultant, needs money. He needs cash. So he has the idea of hiring a writer to basically ghostwrite his investigations, to be the Watson to his Holmes, as I said, or Hastings to his Poirot. And the writer he chooses is me. And what that does is it takes me off the sort of top of the hill, because normally when a writer writes a whodunit, he or she sees everything in the world of the whodunit, knows who did it and knows where the clues are and knows everything. But once I'm inside the book, tagging along behind a character who actually I didn't even like that much, I am absolutely baffled and beguiled. So I've lost my power as author and I've become a slightly sort of hopeless sidekick.
Yeah, and this was one of the things I wanted to ask you about. You do have this quite prickly relationship with Hawthorne. I asked myself, is this something that actually happens with between you and characters, even when you're not pretending that they're real?
No, normally I begin by really rather liking my characters, you know, Alex Rider, or, you know, I have a James Bond book coming out this time, and I really love James Bond. So normally the relationship of the writer to his central character is one of great affection. I think that I do like Hawthorne, despite his failings as a human being, and he has quite a few of them. I actually like him, but I don't think it would be possible to read the book and enjoy the book if there wasn't a sort of a relationship at the heart of it that was one of respect. And you know, the thing about Hawthorne is that he's very, very clever. I mean, he does solve crimes, and he does make plenty of observations, which I'm unable to. So I do like him. What the relationship really turns on is I want to know more about him. I don't know in the book where he's come from, what difficulties he's had in his life that have made him so problematic as a human being. And that, I think, is true of the writing process, that when you begin writing a character, you sort of know them quite well. But if you then write a series, and I wrote, after all, 11 Alex Rider books, the more you write, the more you find out about your character. And all I'm doing in The Word is Murder is I'm making that a sort of a real investigation, and in that instead of just sitting and imagining what Hawthorne might be like, I actually try and work out and try and discover the secrets of his past.
Yes, but I was not talking so much about whether you liked him or not, but more this kind of issue of control, because...
Well, you're right to put your finger on it. I have no control over him. At one stage in the book, I say to him, look, if you don't solve this murder, I'm in trouble. I don't have a book. And I think that's one of the fun aspects of what I've done with the book, which is that, you know, I've changed the rules. Because now, instead of saying, you know, the solution is chapter 20 or 21 and this is it, I am sort of desperately thrashing around in the hope that it will arrive. I have lost my power as author.
And it seems like, you know, just right in the beginning, there is even a question as to whether you're going to be making up things as they go in order to create, you know, the book that you want, versus what he's saying is that, you know, you better do it my way.
Well, that's right. You know, this is part of the fun, Francesca. And to be honest with you, you know, it's important for me to be, or listeners should understand, that fun was what this is all about. I really wanted this to be something completely fresh and different. And it is true that we have tussled, Hawthorne and I. There's a moment in the book, which is one of my favorite moments, where he expresses some views which are frankly homophobic. And I, as the author, and as a man who is, you know, the exact opposite of that, I'm horrified. But that then leads to a conversation in the book as to whether a character who expresses views with which, you know, are well-meaning and modern people do not agree, whether such a character can even exist now in a book. And I think that is a conversation that's worth having.
Could you say a little bit more about that? What do you mean a character could even like that?
Well, I mean, I think that these days, because of the Me Too movement and because of various sensitivities, we are increasingly moving into a field in which writers can all too easily give offense. Look at the argument around cultural appropriation. Now, I want to say straight up that I have no problem with any of these movements and any of these discussions. I think they're healthy. I think they're good for literature. But nonetheless, there is a danger in all this that if we're not careful, we are going to end up self-censoring, or we as writers are going to become afraid of what we can write for fear of giving offense to a minority group or to a majority group. And I think that it is very valid, therefore, to write books which are broadly entertainments, which nonetheless touch on the question of what it is now admissible to write, and whether there are any areas off limits. So if you have a character, for example, like Hawthorne, who expresses views which I think the vast majority of people would not agree with, you have to ask whether I, as the author, whether it is valid for me to even put those into a book. That's the times we live in. It also, incidentally, allows me to explore Hawthorne more, because I think it's interesting that somebody who has views which are disagreeable broadly has those views for a reason. And I think that literature, whether it's entertainment or great literature, has a job to do examining how people get to be the way they are. And that's what I'm trying to do in this book.
Yes, you know, you kind of jumped the gun a bit on a question that I had over cultural appropriation, because I was reading where you had said that your publisher had pressured you into dropping a black character. And then you got critics who came
back. That isn't actually completely true, Francesca. I mean, I certainly never said that. But what I did say was that a publisher had advised me to be careful if I was going to introduce a black character into a children's book. And as often happens with these things, the press rather ran away with that. No pressure was put on me, and I don't accept pressure anyway. I've been writing long enough not really to worry about what I should or shouldn't do insofar as other people are telling me that. You know, obviously I have responsibilities to myself, I have my own voice, and I have my own, you know, morality, which I try to express in my work. But I thought it was interesting that a publisher was nervous of that, and there is definitely a discussion happening more, I think, on your side of the Atlantic than over here about whether it is now appropriate for a writer like myself to write about ethnicities to which I do not belong. And I think, as I say, that is a healthy conversation to be having. I have my own views on it, but I don't think that the discussion should be ignored.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there have been certainly arguments saying that, you know, white people have been remiss in not writing about...
Of course, that's the other side of the equation. When you're trying to write children's books, in this case, YA fiction, Alex Rider, for a multicultural audience, when you want to reach out to children who are black or who are Muslim or who are, you know, whatever, from different ethnicities, different cultures, I think it is probably a good thing and a healthy thing to introduce characters with whom they can identify. I'm not suggesting a tick list of characters or, you know, doing it simply for sort of some kind of pragmatism, but I don't think there's necessarily any harm in it. But at the same time, I do see the other side of the argument.
You know, and I've spoken to other authors also who have written about characters who come from different ethnic backgrounds and their own. I mean, it seems to me an author has to be open to the entire human experience. Isn't that true?
I would agree with that. I mean, you know, the ultimate destination, if you decide that, you know, you can only write about people who you are identified with, is that I will spend the rest of my life writing about 63-year-old white men living in London, you know, born in North London, etc., etc., which is absurd. It is exactly the job of the writer to look on the other side of the fence and to try and appropriate as much of the world as he or she possibly can. But as I say, these days, there are new sensitivities that we have to be aware of. Certainly writing James Bond, this is absolutely and obviously true. And I think it would be foolish. I am aware that I have, you know, publishers and booksellers and a lot of people who depend on my books doing well. So it is beholden upon me to make sure that I am aware and sensitive to, you know, current mores.
Now, of course, in this book, you did write about a 63-year-old white...
Well, as it happens, I did, yes.
So back to this book, Anthony Horowitz, back to The Word is Murder. Now, we haven't even said anything about the plot, and we won't say much about it because we'll leave that to the reader to pick it up. But it is about a woman, Diana Cowper, who visits an undertaker to plan her funeral. And hours later, she's strangled. So tell us what you'd like to, as far as we can, to give us a sense of the plot of this book.
Well, You know, I'm glad, Francesca, you've reminded me, because once again, you know, when I talk about the word is murder, it becomes all too easy to sort of go up different avenues to, you know, into the realm of metafiction and political correctness and all these other discussion points. At the end of the day, what you have here is a fun murder mystery. Diana Cooper, who is the mother of a famous actor who is doing very well in Hollywood, arranges her own funeral, which is to say she chooses the hymns and the prayers and the location and everything about it, and then goes home and is promptly murdered. And Hawthorne is called in because he specializes in cases that are unusual or peculiar, ones that are likely to baffle the sort of conventional police. And that is only the first murder in the book. There is a second murder further down the line, and it's an investigation which takes him into the sort of life of this woman and into her past history, when a long time ago she was involved in a fatal car accident. She, of course, was not the one who was killed. She was driving, and maybe what happened in this terrible accident is somehow echoing down through the sort of decades and has been responsible for her death. So, and along the way, there are a lot of, you know, fun activities and actions that happen. I'm slightly stuttering on this phone because I'm watching this most extraordinary display outside. A fork of lightning just missed St. Paul's by what it looked like inches.
Wow.
Sorry.
I can imagine that. I hope somebody took a picture. We can find it later.
I'm sure.
Online.
You look at the papers tomorrow. Someone will have.
Yes. You know, and it's not just about writing that this book gives you the opportunity to explore writing mystery fiction. There's also part of the plot involves theater. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that, the experience of, you know, the Royal Shakespeare Theater and the Stratford and all that. Is that something that you've had intimate knowledge of?
Well, I do have a certain amount of knowledge of theater because I've had two plays put on the stage in London in my time. In fact, there's one at this very moment. And I'm also on the board of trustees for the Old Vic, which is one of London's oldest and most loved theatres, and which is also a charity. It receives no government funding, and I take that responsibility very seriously. I love going there. And all my life, I've been interested in writing theatre. So writing about actors, and this book also takes me into the world of RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, where young students are taught the acting, and from where many of our greatest actors have come. So I'm very much at home writing about this sort of material. And further down the line, I have a book, I think it's about number 4 or 5, because I'm seeing this as a series of maybe 10 books. I have a story called The Knives Are Out, which involves the death of a theater critic. So I'll be looking again more closely at the whole subject of theater writing and the relationship between the writer and the critic.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with best-selling master of the crime genre, Anthony Horowitz. He's written numerous books, screenplays, and plays of crime fiction, including House of Silk, Magpie Murders, and now the first in a new series, The Word is Murder. And since you have this series planned, is this going to be an opportunity not only for you to explore your character Hawthorne, but also to explore yourself?
Well, I think certainly I'll explore the character of Hawthorne. I'm already in the second book, Another Word for Murder, dropping hints about things that have happened to him and what, you know, what shadows are haunting him from the past. So that'll be a large part of it. I don't think I'm going to spend too much time writing about myself. I mean, you know, really, when I pitched this idea to my publishers, they were nervous, because if people get the idea that this is some kind of ego trip, that this is me writing about how wonderful I am and all the rest of it, I think the series is bound to fail, and it really isn't that. You know, it is writing about writing, and yes, I'm a writer. But within the word is murder, although a lot of it is true, and incidentally, I should tell you, it's quite fun that in Britain, when the book came out, people went on to Google to try and work out what was true and what wasn't inside the book. You know, it is very much my aim to always be a subsidiary character, the narrator, not the star.
Yeah, well, that was actually going to be my next question. How much is memoir and how much is fiction? And actually, I fully intended to do some of that Googling myself.
Well, I mean, you know, it is true that I have worked with major directors like Spielberg and Jackson, both get a mention. I have obviously written Foyle's War, and that's part of the story, too. I am married to a lady called Jill Green, who is the producer of Foyle's War. You know, these things you can find on Wikipedia easily enough. And you know, the Clerkenwell, my home in Clerkenwell is one of the settings for the books. That's where I'm talking from now. But as I say, it is, you know, if you think about the Sherlock Holmes novels, at the end of the day, how much do you really know about Watson? You know he's a doctor. You know he was wounded in the first Afghanistan war. You know his wife was called Mary and that she died. You don't know a great deal more than that. He is the voice of the book, but not the focus of it. I really am trying to pull the same sort of trick with this book and with the ones that follow.
Yes, and now I'm debating whether I should ask you this or not, because I know you probably are not all that comfortable talking about yourself, and you've just said that this
book is... Not at all. Anything you ask, I'm very happy to answer.
Okay. So I was also reading a bit about your past, your growing up. You had quite a difficult childhood, despite being born into, you know, a fair amount of wealth. That wealth was lost when your father got into some pretty serious trouble, and you also experienced a lot of brutality, I mean, real out-and-out brutality in the British boarding school system, which I think was notorious for that when you were in school in the 1960s. So what I wanted to actually ask you was, one of those experiences, the traumas of growing up that you went through, what kind of bearing does that have on your choice of writing mystery fiction?
I think that my peculiar childhood, which was on the one hand extremely wealthy, but on the other hand pretty unpleasant, particularly, as you correctly say, because of my schooling, which incidentally many, many men of my age from this country have been through and know all about. So it's not a rare experience, I'm sad to say, although of course it's now one which is, you know, very much in the past. This drove me into writing. It drove me into books as a solace. It drove me into writing. And I think from the very day I began writing, I was trying to escape, in a way, from myself and from my experiences. That's why I was so keen on adventure stories. I love plot. I love story. I love action. And I love mystery and magic and surprises. I try not to be a particularly introspective writer. I'm much more interested in giving readers a fun ride. But that ride, for me, is a ride away from where I was. And the question I sometimes ask myself and have been asked is, you know, would I exchange success as a writer in my adulthood for a happy childhood and less sort of unpleasantness at this school? And to that question, I don't really know the answer. I'm just aware that those very formative years from 8 to about 18 turned me into the writer that I am, and I knew I would be this writer when I was 10 years old. I had no doubt in my mind as a really quite small boy that writing and books would be my life.
In fact, I read that you would tell stories to counter the bullying that you were subject to. Is that right?
Yes, we slept in dormitories. So there'd be about 8 or 9 boys in a room, and these dormitories were, you know, quite scary places, you know, in the sense that the atmosphere in this school was so oppressive, the violence, you know, that the teachers used against children was so extreme. There were also, I later discovered, many, many examples of sexual assaults on children. I never knew any of that at the time, but I've met other boys from the school since who have told me about this. So there was a very, very unpleasant, oppressive atmosphere in the school. And I did tell stories at night to the other children in the dormitory, which were very popular because they took people away from the school. They were always stories of escape, two boys running away, having adventures, having fun, being friends. And so it wasn't so much the bullying that I was shielding the other kids from. It was the actual oppression of the school itself. There were bullies in the school. I myself bullied other children. It's what happens when you're in that sort of oppressive atmosphere. It does easily bring out the very worst in you.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Anthony Horowitz about his latest work of crime fiction, The Word is Murder. Well, and then now, on a lighter note of some of the things that you speak about in this book, you talk about working with Steven Spielberg. I assume the book is taking place around 2011, because that's when you were discussing actually doing Tintin 2 with Steven Spielberg. You worked on the script for the first Tintin film. What was it like to work with Spielberg as a director, as a screenwriter?
Well, as I say in the book, I mean, I revere Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson, for that matter. They are the two greatest filmmakers of my lifetime, and I love so many of their films, and their films have had such a huge impact on me. And meeting them was both terrifying and exhilarating. I mean, terrifying because they have such extraordinary creative minds and such great presence, and terrifying because I was worried I wouldn't, you know, come up to scratch, that I wouldn't be able to give them what they wanted. And it may well be that I didn't, because, you know, the first Tintin film happened, but there wasn't a second one or a third one. And as I say in the book, I don't know why not. You know, it's not for me to know. Maybe it will happen one day. But, you know, there was a book once called Meetings with Remarkable Men. I remember that title. And certainly they are two of the most remarkable men I ever met. And again, you know, I don't really give anything away. I mean, I don't speak out of turn, because that would be not appropriate. But I do describe quite honestly the feelings of working with them for a brief time and knowing them.
Yeah, in fact, it was reported in March that Tintin 2 is going to be made sometime in the next 3 years, I believe.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, Peter Jackson is set up to direct it. He is a genius. I thought the first film was wonderful. You know, I'm quite surprised, really. I mean, I guess they're both very busy. They've both been doing quite a lot since then. You know, Jackson has done the three more of The Lord of the Rings, which isn't just a small amount of work, so knock off one wet afternoon. You know, these are two powerhouses of talent, and whatever they do will be great.
As are you, and I greatly look forward to the next one in the series. When you say that it was, you wrote it to be fun to read, it was, I think, the most fun mystery I have ever read, so you certainly succeeded in that. Anthony Horowitz, thank you so much for talking with us here.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Anthony Horowitz is the author of many works of crime fiction, including novels, screenplays, and plays. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Word is Murder. Next week on Writer's Voice, we honor two momentous anniversaries, one a hard-won victory, the other a terrible tragedy. June 6, 1944 was D-Day, when the Allies invaded Western Europe in the largest amphibious attack in history. The victory was that the Allies were able to establish a beachhead on the Atlantic coast despite the formidable defenses of the German army and begin the liberation of France. We talk with novelist Stephen Kiernan about his book, The Baker's Secret. The action culminates on D-Day, but it's told from the perspective of French civilians who were liberated on that day. Then, June 6, 1968, was the day that Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, just a few months after the assassination of Martin Luther King. We talk with David Margalek about his book, The Promise and the Dream, The Untold Story of Martin Luther King, Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy. That's all coming up next week on Writer's Voice. We have just enough time for a poem. Here's David Wagoner reading his poem, Their Bodies.
Their Bodies. To the students of anatomy at Indiana University. That gaunt old man came first, his hair as white as your scoured tables. Maybe you'll recollect him by the scars of steel mill burns on the backs of his hands, on the nape of his neck, on his arms, and sinewy legs, and her by the enduring innocence of her face, as open to all of you in death as it would have been in life. She would memorize your names and ages and pastimes and hometowns if she could, but she can't now, so remember her. They believed in doctors, listened to their advice, and followed it faithfully. You should treat them one last time as they would have treated you. They had been kind to others all their lives and believed in being useful. Remember, their son, somewhere, is trying hard to believe you'll learn as much as possible from them as he did, and will do your best to learn politely and truly. They gave away the gift of those useful bodies against his wish. They had their own ways of doing everything, always. If you're not certain which ones are theirs, be gentle to everybody.
That was poet David Wagner reading his poem, Their Bodies. Thanks to the Poetry Foundation for that piece. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.